term global health is a colonial one, any way you look at it. So why do we want to decolonize a term that we did not actually create ourselves? And I've heard actually a lot of really talented and thoughtful people on the African continent saying really good things about how we need to decolonize. But I've heard more people who are based in the countries that colonized us in the first place talking about decolonizing global health. So it becomes very difficult for me to sort through all of this mixture of call it wheat and chaff and be able to understand what it is that we should be doing and what it is that we shouldn't be doing.
The decolonized global health movement has grown in popularity in recent times. And is this movement new? Is it helpful? Is it harmful? Today, we are privileged to have an expert who has been working in global health for many years and is sharing her thoughts on this issue.
Hello and welcome to the Global Health Unfiltered podcast, a podcast about untold stories in Africa and beyond. Thank you for joining us on today's episode. I'm your guest host, Yao Bidiakon, and I'm joined by Ella Amwako.
Today, our guest is Prof. Iruka Okeke. Iruka is a professor in pharmaceutical microbiology at the University of Ibadan, Nigeria. Her research investigates mechanisms of bacteria that colonize humans and what causes drug resistance. Behind the scenes, she tries to decolonize global health, even though she studies bacteria that colonize human beings. Iruka is a fellow of both the Nigerian and African Academies of Science. She's a Callistus Juma Science Leadership Fellow as well, and is a recipient of the 2023 Peter Wiley Microbiology Prize. She's written and co-authored many scientific papers and book chapters. She has also recently published her own book.
All right, so welcome, Iruka. Thank you so much for joining. And I should add, I'm also a Callistus Juma Fellow, just at least that's the one thing I have, one of the few accolades I have in common with Professor Okeke. But anyway, as you know, as somebody who has extensive experience in what the so-called field of global health, I guess the first question is, what does global health mean to you? It's a bit of an amorphous term that some people like, some people completely hate. So I'd love to know where you fall on that spectrum. And then perhaps from that, what is the state, what is the current state of global health in your view?
Yeah, it's a great question, yeah. And thanks for having me on the podcast. It's really nice to be able to chat with you on these matters. I am actually a global health being the term skeptic. I ask people who use the term to define it to me, and I'm not too happy with the definitions that I get back. I recognize that some of the work that I do is actually characterized as global health. So in being critical of the term, I'm not critical of everything that is sort of under that umbrella. But I think the term is problematic because if you look at it as a dictionary term, global and health, you're really talking about health, probably public health in the whole world. But when people speak of global health, they're typically talking about health in poor countries, not even necessarily resource limited settings in rich countries. And so I think the term is actually used to mean other things without obviously stating what those other things are. And so I'm very passionate about public health, particularly in less resourced settings like in Africa, but I do have problems with the way the term global health is used.
Okay. So I guess taking that into account, then what would you say is the current state of, I guess, public health in low resource settings, if we take your sort of new definition?
You know, I'll let you use global health if you need to. I use it myself sometimes. I think what the terminology and the, let's call it a field, has done is actually to attract resource and interest to what was once several neglected areas of healthcare and study. I think public health in African countries, in particular, where I'm most familiar, is grossly underfunded. It's very neglected. It's an area where, with a few resources, you can actually get a lot of impact. And so I think the fact that several individuals and organizations have used, you know, the umbrella of global health to make some impact is actually quite commendable. I think we have a long way to go. I think part of the problem is that the people with the problems in what is known today as global health don't often have the voice to talk about what the problems are and where the resources should be directed. And that may be the greatest problem.
Right. Thank you. And it makes so much sense. And those of us who work on this part of the world actually see that the funder decides where the funding should go. And I mean, I can't blame them, right? Because it's their money. So they have to decide where the money should go. But over the course of your career and over the time that you have worked, what do you believe are the successes, like the success stories so far in global health? I know that the term alone is a challenge, it's not a success. But what do you think the successes are so far? And after that, could you talk about some of the challenges? I know you've mentioned a few, but if there are any others that you would want to add on.
Yeah, I'm a microbiologist, and so I'll give examples that are sort of in the microbiology infectious disease sphere, but that's not to say this is the only place where we've seen successes. One example that many people will be familiar with is HIV. I think HIV still has a long way to go. There's still far too many people getting infected with this virus who should not. And there are far too many people who need to manage their infections that aren't getting the best access to care. That being said, HIV is one area where the importance of laboratory medicine, clinical virology has now come to the fore and been recognized. Most patients who are HIV positive will get that diagnosis based on a lab test. And I think it took several years, actually decades, to get to that point. But the fact that we are at that point, I think, is a huge success. The idea that things that measure viral load and CD4 counts are now considered as what should be standard and accessible to everybody who is at risk of HIV, even though we haven't necessarily yet achieved that. The fact that the discourse is that, you know, patients should be able to access this, I think, is a huge success. Several decades ago, that wasn't the case. Laboratory medicine was presumed to be too expensive for patients that needed it to be able to access it routinely. Another example of a success I can give actually is in the area of malaria. Several decades ago, malaria research was really centered outside of malaria endemic areas. There's still a huge bias in terms of what gets done and who does it. But we can now recognize around the continent of Africa, in Africa endemic countries, research leaders who have domestic research programs that are addressing the epidemiology of malaria. I think that, again, there's a long way to go there, but the fact that this is now considered the norm and not an aberration, I think, is huge progress. I suppose areas where we do need more progress is that outside of HIV, malaria, and tuberculosis, for example, it's very difficult to get attention to diseases that are endemic in the countries where global health is practiced. And the fact that global health really has had this vertical focus, a disease by disease focus, when the people who are the target of global health programs are really not choosing which diseases to have. So I think the fact that health systems haven't been able to keep up with the areas of progress, and that, you know, some of the examples I gave you, access to laboratory medicines, and I should also add access to antiretrovirals for HIV, has not necessarily translated to access to laboratory medicine more broadly. It has in some cases, but not as broad as we would like, or access to medicines more broadly, is one area where I think we have a huge challenge, and I don't really see the route to solving that in the short term. So I think we have a lot of work to think about how health systems can be more holistic and really address all of the areas of need for patients wherever they may be. I suppose another area where we have a challenge is that, I'm sure you've heard this before, most of the people who are delivering healthcare are both in wealthy and in resource-limited settings, actually female. And very few of the people who are actually making the decisions about what work should be done and where and who should be compensated and how are not female. And so I think that is a huge challenge that public health in general and global health as well has to address.
I guess you're a microbiologist, but one question following on from what you said is also, you know, the idea that health in low resource settings, let's take Africa as a case in point, is not just infectious disease. So even though you are, you know, I know you're a microbiologist and you think about infections a lot, you know, there's growing evidence or there's growing burden of non-communicable diseases. And yet just from where I sit, it appears as though the quote unquote global health community, or certainly the funders of global health, still have programs that are largely focused and based upon infectious disease control. So just kind of asking, what do you see as perhaps steps? Well, first of all, do you recognize this also as an issue, but also what steps perhaps need to be taken to begin to diversify the field to allow research and then obviously ultimately improved healthcare in areas that are not infectious disease, but still obviously causing large amounts of morbidity?
Yeah, it's a very important observation. And I think when I said I was going to give examples, I said I'd rather give examples that are closer to my expertise, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they're the most important examples. I think we have a huge problem that global health is presented on a disease by disease basis. And it so happens that, you know, this field started from malaria, TB, and HIV, which are all infectious diseases. And right behind them come diarrheal diseases and pneumonia and so on. And then after that, maybe we'll start to look at non-communicable diseases. I think this is hugely problematic, and it's the reason why what is done in the field of global health really needs to be dictated by the people who are going to be impacted by global health programs. It's not just a question of infection or not infection. You think about who uses institutions that are supported by global health programs is typically people who have young children. They're built around childhood diseases. To an extent, they're built around maternal health. And then you take a disease like hypertension now that is really has this really high but hidden burden on the African continent that is carried largely by men who never visit healthcare facilities for any reason whatsoever. And so, you know, how do you leverage a global health program to be able to deal with hypertension, but you don't even have a way into the facilities for the people who are carrying a huge part of the hypertension burden? And so I think we really have to stop looking at healthcare in our countries, my own included, from this global health perspective. We need to really think about what is needed for health in general, and how are we to deliver it? You know, a very similar example is that, you know, now we have HPV vaccines that can protect women from cancer in the future. And again, these need to be given to girls who are in primary and secondary schools. And we don't have health systems that actually reach those people very well. And so now as African countries are thinking about, well, we want to introduce these vaccines, there's a huge question about, well, where do we actually find the people that need them? And sort of keep a record of who's getting them. It's very different from what you would do with a childhood EPI vaccine program, which is sort of a hallmark of how global health was originally designed to deliver care.
No, that's very helpful. I mean, I think, and it follows, you know, turning our conversation sort of to the theme of today, which is really, we've established what global health is, maybe, or isn't, or, you know, anyway, we've sort of danced around it. The next thing that everybody talks about these days is decolonize global health. You know, it's almost cliched now.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks they are decolonizing. even the colonizers thought decolonizing. So I guess, you know, it'd be interesting to get your perspective. What does decolonization of global health mean to you, to Professor Okeke in Ibadan?
And if she were to decolonize global health, what would she do? What would be your next steps if you were to decolonize global health?
Gosh, you and our listeners are going to think I'm such a skeptic. If I hate the term global health, the decolonizing global health is worse. And not so much because, I mean, when it first came out, I was actually interested. There's a lot of decolonization that has to happen worldwide of a lot of different things. I think a couple of things were problematic. First of all, the term global health is a colonial one, any way you look at it. So why do we want to decolonize a term that we did not actually create ourselves? And I've heard actually a lot of really talented and thoughtful people on the African continent saying really good things about how we need to decolonize. But I've heard more people who are based in the countries that colonized us in the first place talking about decolonizing global health. So it becomes very difficult for me to sort through all of this mixture of, I'll call it wheat and chaff, and be able to understand what it is that we should be doing and what it is that we shouldn't be doing. That being said, I think the fact that this conversation is happening is so valuable, because even the most skeptical people now on either side are actually forced to think about the fact that, well, am I a colonist? Am I being colonized? What does this term global health mean? I mean, I've been saying that for decades. And now in the decolonizing global health space, that discussion is happening. So as much as I don't like the labels, I think the fact that we can now actually put things on the table and interrogate them is useful. And I'm hoping that it will lead us to a better place. I can see some positives that are already coming out of it. I think there are too few to satisfy me. But when I think about what happened before we started decolonizing global health, there was no conversation at all. There was no place to raise these things. And so now that the conversation is happening, I think good things could actually happen. And bad things potentially could stop. Now when people are stepping into global health, there's a body of literature that is growing that they will read, and then they will think about, well, huh, what am I doing? Am I a colonist? Am I a white savior? What am I? I think those sorts of things would not necessarily have come to an undergraduate student or a medical student who's thinking of having, who's perhaps based in a Western country and thinking of having an experience in an African country. Now they can actually be thoughtful and sort of not be steered in the colonial way, the way that would have happened 2 decades ago.
Okay. yeah, thank you very much. I like how you put that. Do you think that the reason why you hear the voices of the colonizers is because they have the platform and people in the global south really don't? Or it's just because they are the funders, so they're the ones who can talk? Why do you think that there's this inequity?
I think it's multiple things. I think you're absolutely right, El. They have a platform. But they built the platform. You know, anybody these days can set up a podcast. How many people are doing that? Of course, it's true that not anybody can get into, you know, a newsroom of an international news agency. Of course, it's, you know, who can get their foot in the door there is really determined by decades of oppression and so on. But I have to say that I think the first thing I would like to see happen is those of us, and I'll put myself in this category as well, those of us who say, oh, we've been disadvantaged sometimes or all of the time or once in a while, I think we first of all need to think about, well, what's it that we can do about it that we're not trying? And then if we push and we get pushed back, then at least we can say we pushed. So I think that is the first thing. The whole idea of, you know, come and talk to us about decolonizing global health means that someone wants to listen to this stuff. And so rather than just saying that, well, a lot of the discourse is coming out of London and so on, maybe we should be taking advantage of that platform that we did not own and saying something on it so that we can change things. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is that we very often, we being, for example, people in African countries, say, well, the funders have the money, he who pays the piper plays the tune and blah, blah, blah. But the first thing is that those of us who are actually doing science or implementation research or health research, public health research in a country like Nigeria, a lot of us are funded from these sources. Not enough, but a lot of us. So it's not like the funders are entirely ignoring experts in African countries, Asian countries, South American countries. They are actually paying attention. Very often what happens is they are funding more people in northern or western countries. And then we need to ask ourselves why. Sometimes, well, it's their taxpayers' money and they want to make sure that that money goes to their research programs. And sometimes when you look at who applies, you realize that they are more likely to submit grant proposals. And even if our success rates are lower, what that should mean is that we are supposed to be putting in more proposals. It may be also that they have expertise that allows them to be more successful when they do put in a proposal. So can we look at ourselves and ask ourselves, well, what expertise do we actually need that we don't have? And how is it that we are going to get it? So I'm not saying that those systemic blocks are not there. I think they're there. I think we have to work to pull them down. But I think we also have to work to pull ourselves up, create platforms so that we can make statements, prepare ourselves to make these statements, say it again and again so that it will eventually get heard, and then take advantage of what is out there. And also challenge our own countries. I mean, our countries are resource limited, but they do have some resources. They should be putting more resources into health, and they should be putting more resources into science and technology. And we need to ask them to do this and make them accountable.
I think you just fell right on Yael's plate. Nodding.
Yeah, no, I think, I mean, Iruka and I have had a number of these conversations whenever we meet. So, I mean, I think we are aligned very much. And I mean, I think I'm getting a sense what you're saying is really the need for African leadership. Now, we can moan about being colonized, but we were not, you know, even the story politically of decolonization was because people within Africa rose up. You cannot be decolonized from outside. The British did not voluntarily give up Ghana and Nigeria. Ghanaians and Nigerians took their countries back. And perhaps, you know, the idea is we need to take ownership and responsibility for our own health. And, you know, whether we like the term or not, it's about who sets the agenda. But you cannot set the agenda if you don't put any resources on the table. And I think that is, you know, we can't expect to set the agenda if we're not willing to put resources forward. In your book, Leapfrogging Laboratories, you talked about, you know, the use of the importance of technology and how technology actually may present opportunities for labs in low resource settings to position themselves to, in some ways, you know, the whole idea of leapfrogging is to skip a few steps and accelerate progress. So I'm wondering if you could unpack that a little bit for us and for the audience, the power of technology, because usually we think of technology as the advantage of high income. You know, if you have lots of gadgets when you have lots of money. But what I'm hearing is technology can actually allow lower resource, poorer people to actually do things quicker than people in high income countries, you know, basically develop quicker than people in high income countries. Best example we have probably is the cell phone and what that has done across Africa for communication. So it'd be good to sort of hear your thoughts based on, you know, what you wrote in that book.
Yeah. Thanks for the question. So the Leapfrogging Labs paper was actually a paper. It's not a book, but it's in it's in BMJ Global Health, I think. So that means it should be free, open access. Anybody can look at it. And in that paper, we were really looking about, well, what technologies can actually help us jump over the roadblocks of previous technologies that have not been implemented in resource-limited settings, such as many of the settings around me in Nigeria. And personally, I think leapfrogging is something that not only can provide an advantage to somebody working in a resource-limited setting, it's something that a resource-limited setting is better placed to be able to do. Now, if you allow me to talk about bacteria for a bit, if you're working with bacteria and you're trying to understand which bacteria are resistant to what, you will have to test many, many, many different bacteria in many, many different ways to be able to get the full picture. Okay, bacterial infections, unlike malaria and HIV, malaria is caused by Plasmodium parasites. HIV is the virus that causes AIDS. Bacterial infections, there's hundreds of different bacteria. Each bacterium grows in a different way, on a different kind of media. You need different reagents to be able to identify it. So Western countries that have had surveillance systems have typically had large labs, typically multi-floor, say four different floors, each with a different room that does a different thing. Now, if you've made that amazing investment, you know, if you were the UK HSA or US CDC, you have this huge building devoted to this. And then another technology comes along that can do it for any bacteria at all in one room, or give it three rooms. There's no reason for you to demolish your multi-story building and build a three-room building. However, if you had nothing at all, there's every reason for you to build a three-room building and try this new technology out. And that's really what we did in Nigeria, using genomics as the reference tool for our antimicrobial resistance surveillance system. And this is what we're talking about in the leapfrogging paper. The idea that if you have nothing, then you have nothing to lose from adopting a new technology. And in actual fact, I firmly believe that African countries are going to show other countries how to leapfrog. So now the US HSA is finally replacing many of those old technologies with genomics. But for them, there was a higher entry bar to be able to do that. For us, we had nothing to lose because it was the only way that we could do that. So we could show how it was done. And I think the mobile phone example you gave, Yao, is a perfect other example where, you know, if you didn't have a whole network of lines, adopting mobile phone technology was really the way to go. We've seen that also with M-Pesa in Eastern Africa. If you don't have a whole lot of banks with tellers sitting in there expecting salaries and so on, banking on mobile phones is really the way to start banking. And so I think this is going to happen in other areas as well. And I think we really want to be ready for it. We want to make sure that our educational systems are such that the graduates coming out of them are so forward thinking that they're going to come up with ideas for technologies that we don't know now. And so it's really important, for example, for our educational systems to be ahead of those in the West, so that we can actually be in a position not just to adopt new technologies, but actually to develop.
No, I think that's, actually what I was going to ask, what you touched on at the very end about education. I mean, given we have this, you know, I guess the lack of resources can be flipped as an opportunity. So we have a lack of resources, or at least a lack of infrastructure. But we have, that means we have a clean slate to sort of build forward. But the question then is our education system, I mean, you're an educator first before anything else, is our education system, which is so often derivative and tries to copy everything we see in the West, is our education system really built to do that, to take advantage of those opportunities? And perhaps, I mean, you touched on it briefly at the end of the last answer, but could you expand a bit on what do African education systems need to do to prepare our students and ultimately graduates to take advantage of these opportunities, so that we don't just try to replicate the long path that the West has taken, but we actually do leapfrog?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I spend roughly half my time teaching undergraduate students, postgraduate students, also interface with people who teach at the primary and secondary care level. And I can tell you, certainly my assessment is that in Nigeria, educational system for science and technology is not fit for purpose. We're taking really smart people and we're teaching them in such a way that they would operate very, very well in 1960s Europe, except that that is not what they are graduating into. I don't know myself how to solve the problem entirely. Certainly in my field, I find that molecular science is introduced too late with too little depth I would advocate for it to be the entry point into biology. And then we can actually learn the taxonomy and all that along the way as we need it. I would advocate for students getting onto computers very early in their education, ideally in nursery school. I think it's a shame that your average Nigerian student completes high school without having any computer skills at all. This is where creativity comes from. If you have a child who has familiarity with computer systems, they will typically start creating things very early in life that even their parents and teachers do not understand. And so I think that we need to expose our children, our trainees, to platforms that allow them to go beyond what we are able to teach them. And until we do that, we need to teach them to be able to get information. We need to teach them to be able to create. We need to teach them to be able to solve problems. And we often call these things soft skills. But these are actually the skills that they need to be able to take all of the information. I mean, all the books behind me, everything that isn't here, is all on the internet for free. So stuffing this down people and asking them to regurgitate what is in them is actually not a good use of anybody's time. We just need to find a way to teach them how to access this information and understand it. And then they'll be able to move beyond this information into things that we cannot imagine.
Thank you very much for that. I mean, I think as we've talked about decolonization, it feels as though the problem is, it's almost more fundamental than that. The whole system has to be reformed. And perhaps it starts at the grassroots with training.
Yeah.
That if you're training doctors or you're training molecular biologists, the paradigm for training has itself to be decolonized. It has to, you know, the system, like you're saying, is 1960s Europe. That was colonial Europe. That was colonial Africa. And in fact, some of our universities, in the way they operate, I think we discussed this when we last met, is some of the procedures and the bureaucracy feels like it's taken out of a history. You know, our professors love the theater of sitting in a room and being in a committee. And we still do things probably that Oxford and Cambridge have stopped doing a long time ago, but we are holding on to them as tradition.
Yeah, we use carbon paper in the University of Ibadan, a lot of it. Why does anybody manufacture carbon paper? What is the use of it? It's messy and it doesn't accomplish the disseminating information around multiple people in a way that, you know, email or an app or something on the internet can do. And so I think we really need to think, you're right, we really need to think about everything ground up. Unfortunately, some of our public universities, like University of Ibadan, are so handicapped by their own bureaucracies that actually even the modalities for making change are not really clear. I'm not necessarily stigmatizing University of Ibadan. I love working here. But I do recognize that some of the new private universities, while they may not have the intellectual resource that we have here, they have the agility. Because they're new, they can leapfrog. And I think they need to take advantage of that and do that and show us how to do it better.
Yeah, no, I think that is probably a point that is not made enough, that it's not just an external problem, but even within the academies of African countries and within African universities, there is a nostalgia for tradition that at times maybe, you know, stifles innovation and stifles the youth. So there's a place for tradition, but there also we need to, and maybe not just innovation for the sake of it, but African-driven innovation, where we try to solve local problems ourselves.
Yeah.
So this has been a fascinating discussion. I think it's really exciting to hear your take and, you know, to think about these issues, I think, in a way that is different. The decolonized discourse focuses a lot on
how to stop the colonizer from colonizing. But sometimes we don't look at what the fundamental issues are. We don't look at ourselves and things that we can actually change and things that we should actually do. So thank you very much for your time. Thank you. This was awesome.
Yeah, it's a masterclass. We'll have to do part two.
I know.
Maybe they'll bring me back again for part two. But yeah, that was awesome.
Well, thanks. It's been a really nice discussion. I think you guys are asking all the right questions. So thank you.